It is 8:30, and we have with us live in the studios once again Jav Parrish and Maria Tomczyk, both with Eat the State. Good morning.
Good morning. Dude, these are good headphones.
Mine feel like they're going to fall off.
All right. Well, next week you guys can switch.
Yeah, I want mine back next week.
All right. So, starting out with last week's local events and police accountability.
Yeah, the City Council appointed panel on police accountability has finished its report for 2007, but of course nobody's read it yet because the panel can't release their report. The City Council put it on hold for liability reasons. The report was finished on May 23rd, but first the City Attorney's Office held it from being released while the City negotiated with a police officers union over their contract. And the City Attorney's Office was worried that if the report was released, then the union would file a grievance and that it would affect the negotiations. Well, the negotiations are over. The City Council voted on the contract and approved it last week. And then, of course, the panel said, well, okay, if you're afraid that the police union is going to file a grievance, we'll delete portions of the report. So they went in and they edited their own report and deleted portions of it. And then they said, okay, it's ready for release now. Well, then the city's lawyers came back to them and said, no, sorry, the report as you've edited it, as it now stands, leaves you open to have lawsuits filed against you by individual police officers. So the panel said, wait a minute. And they went to the City Council and they said to the City Council President, Richard Conlon, look, we can be indemnified against lawsuits from individual police officers if you give the okay to release and distribute this report. And Conlon declined to do that. So the report remains confidential and it hasn't been released.
Yeah, when they say that it won't be released for liability reasons, they're primarily talking about political liability.
Yeah, I think so.
On the other hand, the council did announce the appointees for the review board, which has been expanded from 3 to 7 people. And to give credit where credit is due, the appointees are actually much more representative of the community than they were when it was a 3-person panel, where the appointees invariably were all people with a law enforcement or judicial system background, which is, you know, hardly the civilian oversight function which was envisioned when the OPA was created. In this case, we had a small business owner, a lawyer and member of the East African Methodist Episcopal Church, a litigation defense lawyer, a clinical psychologist specializing in drug prevention, a couple of ex-cops, and somebody from the King County Prosecuting Attorney's Office. So it's actually a pretty good mix, but at the same time, we shall see what kind of power they're actually given to review cases. They don't have subpoena power as yet, which makes it very, very difficult to determine whether internal reviews have been fair and impartial or not.
Yeah, and even though they're supposed to be able to review any file that they want, to request and receive any file that they want from the police department, this year's report, which hasn't been released, there's some indication, a little bit of rumor about what that report contains. Part of the rumors say that it's a criticism of the police department for not providing the records that were requested by the OPA.
And not only requested, but legally required to be provided.
To be released. So, you know, and then there's the question of if this review panel can do its investigations, and issue these reports, but the reports are never made public and nothing ever comes out of them, what then is the whole point of the panel?
Yeah, and at what point does that become more of a farce of, you know, civilian oversight, but no public record of what that oversight means?
All right. Moving on, also at City Hall this week, there was a public hearing on styrofoam.
Yeah, the City Council held its
polystyrene.
Yes, it's polystyrene. The City Council held its first public hearing on the plastic grocery bag fee and the ban on polystyrene food containers. It's the proposed regulations will go into effect January 1st if they're approved. They would include a 20-cent charge for every plastic grocery bag used in a store, and an outright ban on styrofoam or polystyrene food containers. There was a lot of support from the public, but there was some resistance from grocery store chains in particular, saying that they want a flat fee per shopper charge rather than a per bag charge. regardless of how little or how much you buy. So someone who goes in and buys 20 bags worth of groceries would pay the same fee as someone who, a single mom who makes almost no money, who goes in and buys 2 bags worth of groceries.
And more to the point, that removes the incentive to actually use cloth bags and conserve.
Yeah. So the city council is going to have another meeting of the Environmental Emergency Management and Utilities Committee to discuss the proposed rules again on July 22nd. So I'm urging people to write, call in, email all the city council members, because any or all of them can attend a committee meeting and vote on the proposed on the proposed changes. So,
all right.
Write in, call in, email, tell them what you think.
All right, and also this week, Mayor Greg Nickels making some proposals for housing.
Yeah, he proposed changes to Seattle's multifamily zones. Those are the areas of the city, between 10 and 20% of the city, that are zoned for apartment buildings, townhouses, and larger complexes. And this, you know, has been coming in response to some work by Sally Clark's planning committee on the city council to review changes to designs and regulations for townhouses. The mayor's jumping in and getting in his proposals now, very developer-friendly. Among some of the things that Nickels wants to do, he wants to allow developers to build taller buildings if they set aside, quote, affordable housing. Again, you know, units that people who make 80 to 100% of median income can afford. And we've been talking about this the last couple of weeks, how that's not really affordable housing. He wants to allow some buildings to be built lot line to lot line as long as their neighbors are apartment or condo buildings. So once again, you know, he wants to eliminate any kind of open space requirements there.
Yes, but you have a nice view of your neighbor's apartment across the way, 4 feet away in the next building.
Oh, yeah. Forget about having a tree outside your window. And he wants to reduce open space requirements to 5% of residential floor area. I guess that's probably enough for the dumpsters behind the building. What do you think, John? And then
small dumpsters, because we're conserving, remember?
Yeah,
we're reducing our garbage output for landfills.
And I say that because it's enough for the dumpsters, because Nickels wants to allow developers to count balconies and rooftops as open space. So that 5% of open space can actually be your balcony.
Rooftops are open space?
And rooftops, yes. And
rooftops have to be accessible, or is it just the fact that you actually have a covering over the building that makes it open space?
Yeah, I wonder. So, and he also wants to get rid of ground-level landscaping requirements and let builders do tiny planting strips, trellises, and rooftop planters instead. So as I said, forget about having a tree outside your window.
All right, anything else on that?
Oh, yeah. The most important part of his proposed changes, this is the most important part, and it's kind of hidden in there, is that the mayor wants to steal the design review process away from neighbors and turn it into a negotiation between developers and the city planning office, so that the small amount of community input that you might have into the way the apartment building down the street is being designed is going to be taken away from you.
Yeah, and let's be honest, because under Nickels, that small neighborhood input has often happened after the deal has been signed and delivered between developers and the city, and it's been ignored. But this would do it away with it entirely.
Yeah, occasionally residents, if they raise a really big stink, can get small changes out of the developer in the design review process. But Nickels wants to do away with that completely. So these are his proposed changes. The city council will talk about them, and it'll require a city council vote to pass them. But I think folks ought to be raising a stink about it.
All right. Speaking of votes, the Seattle School Board voted for a pay raise this week.
Yeah, Maria Goodloe Johnson celebrated her first anniversary of being the superintendent of Seattle Schools. And as a reward, she got something that, let's face it, a lot of us get in these economic boom times, a 10% annual raise.
I cannot believe.
Thank you for laughing. That was the intended response.
10%. I cannot believe
that. It's now, she now gets $264,000 a year, which is approximately what Greg Nichols makes and Christine Gregoire make combined.
I was going to say.
And nearly $100,000 more than Rajmanas, her predecessor. What is more interesting, though, because, you know, by all accounts, Goodloe Johnson has done a fairly decent job in her first year. That's not really the issue. The issue is that the school board, and remember the reform-minded school board, was basically voted out and replaced by a lot of the good old boyism that plagued the school board up through 2003. Well, now we're starting to see what that looks like again. The 10% pay raise for the superintendent came on an item that was added to the public agenda for the school board meeting at the very last minute. There was nothing on the website about it. There was no public review, no time for public comment, and then it was just quietly pushed through. And when one of the school board members, I believe it was school board president Cheryl Chow, was challenged on this by somebody who happened to be at the meeting, she said, well, basically, we wanted to expedite the process. We felt we can't delay it for a month because we felt it was important to get it through sooner.
With no reason given.
This reeks of the sort of cliquishness and insularity that made the Seattle School Board up through the early part of this decade incredibly hostile to public input, and in some cases at the staff level, that's always been the case, even through the school board changes. And it looks like we're going back to the bad old days, and this is very symptomatic of it and very troubling. Even though it really isn't Goodloe Johnson's fault, you know, she's not going to turn down the money.
What it reminds me of, though, is the Port of Seattle, the way they operate.
They're very similar, actually. They've been very similar, although the port has much more corporate corruption than the school board does. But the basic attitude of hostility toward public input and public accountability is the same.
Yeah.
All right, moving on to King County and one of their land use ordinances.
Oh, yeah. The state appellate court ruled this week to overturn a King County land use ordinance requiring rural property owners to leave 50 to 65% of their land in natural vegetation if their land is part of a designated critical area. And some examples of that would be if you bought property that was on a stream side or a steep slope that's susceptible to erosion, or if it's in a wetland. The ordinance was passed so that the county would comply with the state's Growth Management Act that required the counties and other localities to set aside larger stream buffers and to deal with erosion issues and runoff issues. And some rural residents, especially those who enjoy living in a natural setting and like trees and plants and wildlife, they support the ordinance, but I think mostly it's speculators, those who buy up rural property on the cheap and are waiting for growth to reach them. Then they want to sell the property and make a killing out of clearing it and developing it. Those are the folks who have taken the county to court.
Yeah,
and got the ordinance overturned.
The CAO ordinance has been controversial ever since it was passed. And, you know, I can see some of the reason for the controversy, because there's always been this tension between the rural part of the county and the city folks that ram things down their throat without a whole lot of consultation. At the same time, the public face of the challenges to the CAO has been the idea of this poor, beleaguered individual who happens to hold land in rural King County and can't do what he wants with his property. Well, there is some of that, but most of the money for the challenge for this has been coming from developers and speculators who want to challenge the Growth Management Act. The actual court ruling involved in this was a very troubling ruling, because it basically ratified the whole theory of government takings needing to be reimbursed, which is a very, very dangerous slope, as Oregon can tell you with Proposition 37 down there.
The court basically privileged private landowners over and above any kind of environmental issues, they did not recognize any kind of environmental benefit to providing natural vegetation, stream buffers, Keeping steep slopes from eroding into streams and so forth. So in other words, they gave privilege to private landowners over everybody and anybody who lives downstream and anybody and everybody who is their neighbor who would like to see some kind of wildlife and some kind of preservation of the land as it is.
Yeah, it's also worth noting that the whole idea of takings legislation was put to statewide voters in Proposition 48 a few years ago and was resoundingly defeated.
Yeah. And fortunately, King County Executive Ron Sims stepped forward this week and said that he's going to appeal the ruling to the state Supreme Court, where he's hoping the state Supreme Court will at least look at the science behind environmental preservation, whereas the appellate court didn't.
Yeah. And actually, the lower court that had initially upheld the CAO did look at that science.
Yeah.
All right. Related to that, this week, the Army Corps of Engineers came out against trees.
When the levee breaks.
Speaking of ignoring science, the Army Corps of Engineers told King County that it can't have any federal money to fix any of its levees that have trees on them. The levees, of course, as you know, levees are almost always, not always, but almost always streamside structures. And because we have the Growth Management Act and because we require our state requires buffers of natural vegetation, including trees, around rivers and streams, there's been some conflict between King County, Pierce County, Snohomish County, et cetera, and the Army Corps of Engineers over having trees on levees.
Yes, the Bush administration is anti-tree. This is what this comes down to.
Yeah, so in King County argues that the science shows that trees not only provide shade and food for salmon, and they help with erosion, King County also argues that tree roots help to hold levees together and combat problems with levees failing during floods, whereas the Army Corps of Engineers says, no, it doesn't think so. The trees have to go. And so because of this argument between them, King County now has to cut about 100 trees or they will lose something like $16.6 million in federal money to make improvements to levees.
Which makes sense since the Army Corps of Engineers really is experts when it comes to determining what causes a levee to fail.
Yes.
having overseen the process so many times now.
Yeah, and I think most importantly that King County, if they cut those trees, it's going to leave the county open to lawsuits from environmental groups, but it's also going to leave them open for lawsuits from rural landowners because of unequal application of these shoreline management rules. And it's also going to undermine the county's appeal of the anti-clearing ordinance that we just talked about.
So. All right. Moving on to national and the EPA and greenhouse gases.
Oh, you want me to talk about that?
Yeah, you talk about that.
Okay, well, the EPA has announced yesterday that it's not going to enforce any greenhouse gas emission regulations before the end of the Bush administration. This has been reported in most news accounts as the EPA's decision, but it's not really the EPA's decision. It's the White House's decision, and they have made it impossible for the EPA to pursue what really has been required by a Supreme Court ruling that is a couple of years old now, that requires that greenhouse gas emissions, which have been scientifically shown to have an adverse impact on human health, fall under the I believe it's the Clean Air Act.
The Clean Air Act, yeah.
And therefore, the EPA has a legal responsibility to develop regulations for regulating them. And this is something that the White House has been extremely resistant to, as it's generally been resistant to anything around climate change or global warming. And now the EPA is just throwing up its hands and say, look, until we get somebody in the White House who believes in science and you know, reality and good things like that, there's absolutely nothing we can do. They won't even open our emails.
Yeah. So until we have regime change in Washington, D.C., nothing is going to get done about global warming.
By the way, my favorite bumper sticker of the week, support our troops, we'll need them to overthrow our government.
All right. Well, EPA is complaining that the White House won't open their emails, but the Senate this week voted for exactly that, opening everybody's emails.
Yeah, it's a pity that they can't apply the surveillance rules to the White House itself. But unfortunately, you know, who's going to watch the watchers and all that? The Senate caved on the FISA regulations. They basically gave the Bush administration everything that they wanted, which is remarkable considering not only that that Bush is extremely unpopular and a lame duck president, but the Bush administration tried to get a nearly identical bill through the Republican-controlled Congress 2 years ago and couldn't do it. But with Nancy Pelosi and Henry Reid shepherding the bill through the Democratic Congress, Bush has been more than happy to sign it. It really is a striking capitulation and failure of leadership on the Democratic side, and unfortunately that includes Barack Obama.
Yeah.
All right. And also this week, the Guantanamo prisoners having their day in court.
Oh, yeah. For the first time, the Guantanamo detainees got their first day in a real court. There was a three-hour court hearing in front of Federal Judge Thomas Hogan. He's the guy who is listening, who is hearing these. He's listening, yes.
He's listening now.
Yes.
He's hearing.
Part of that surveillance thing.
He's hearing on behalf of other federal court judges the 200 cases for Guantanamo Bay in detainees. And basically what's at issue before him right now is the Justice Department wants about 8 weeks to get together all of the evidence and provide it to the lawyers for the Guantanamo detainees. In addition, they want time. They want extra time to update and add to the evidence. And Hogan appears to be questioning the need to do that. That if the government didn't have adequate evidence in the first place, why'd they hold these guys for so many years? He basically held out his hand and shook his finger at the government at the government lawyers and said, "Look, set aside every other case that's pending in your division and address this case first." So basically he said, quit stalling. These guys need their day in court.
Yeah, did the news account specify which finger he was wagging?
No.
At them?
No, that was me saying, look, you know, that was me doing a little bit of editorialism there. But basically he scolded, really gave them a good scolding and said, you can't stall any longer. These guys have a right to a trial by jury. Let's get it done.
All right. Well, speaking of wagging their fingers, the G8 met this week.
Yeah, the G8 at the G8 summit. The big issue at the G8 summit really was trying to come to some kind of agreement on limitations on greenhouse gases. And at the end of the day,
brace yourself. This is going to be a big surprise.
Yeah, all they came up with is we support. Setting some kind of goal eventually on reducing emissions by maybe about 50% by 2050. But there was no set goal. There was no discussion of how to go about it or anything. And the interesting thing about this immense failure on the part of all these nations to reach any kind of an agreement is that it was depicted in the U.S. media as being developing nations like India and China who were dragging their feet about setting a goal, when in fact what happened there was China and India said to the G8 nations, we are willing to set a goal of reducing our emissions by 50% by 2050. If you in the West, particularly in the U.S., commit to some kind of reduction, they didn't specify how much, some kind of reduction in your greenhouse gas emissions by the year 2020. That's what they said. They said, we will reduce our emissions by 2050 if you commit to reducing your emissions by 2020. And basically George Bush sat there and squirmed, and he said, I can't do that. I won't do that.
Yeah, it was really the U.S. who dragged their feet in these negotiations. The other important part of this, and bear in mind that the science is telling us that we don't need a 50% reduction by 2050. We need 80%.
80 to 90%.
Yeah.
Is
that this is a process that has been designed by the United States to compete with and overshadow the process, the much more comprehensive process that's being negotiated through the United Nations. This is George Bush saying, we in the industrialized North, and particularly the United States, are going to call the shots on any kind of international agreement to control greenhouse gases, and we don't care what the rest of the world thinks. And unfortunately, because despite the increase in places like China and India, the United States in particular is still by far the largest producer of greenhouse gases. I've said it before and I've said it again, of all the crimes against humanity that have been committed by the Bush administration over the last 8 years, I think historians, if there are any left, are going to look back at these years and say that the greatest crime that was committed by these people was their intransigence on global warming at a critical time for global cooperation.
All right, moving on, Iraq.
Yeah, interesting developments this week on the security pact that's been secretly or not so secretly rammed down the throat, negotiated by the United States and Iraq. Prime Minister Maliki came out this week sort of recognizing political reality because the Iraqi parliament isn't about to sign off on any kind of such agreement and said that Iraq would not sign a security agreement with the United States unless it included a specific timetable for U.S. withdrawal of troops. This has been the first time that the Iraqi government has specifically said not just that we would kind of like to see these troops leave eventually, but demanded a timeline and tied it to an important piece of policy that the Bush administration wanted. And of course, the United States rejected that out of hand, saying we want to leave that decision to the commanders on the ground, having, of course, no input available to the country that's actually being occupied. And it clarified very much that this is not the Iraqis who want us there for security. This is the United States imposing its will.
All right. And Afghanistan.
Yeah, an interesting development this week in Afghanistan, where once again a U.S. airstrike killed a bunch of civilians going to a wedding party, in this case 47 of them.
Happens a lot, doesn't it?
Yeah, this is a pattern of mass civilian casualties from U.S. airstrikes that has happened again and again in Afghanistan, and it's become an extremely sensitive political question because, understandably, Afghanis are not very enthusiastic about this. What's more interesting is this story was almost entirely ignored in U.S. media, and very telling is, for example, the AP headline that was used on this story. They did report it, although that report was not run in most of AP subscriber newspapers. The headline that they gave it was, quote, 47 Afghan civilians killed by U.S. bombs, group says. Well, that... that implies that it's some sort of NGO making this accusation, and it's maybe not particularly credible. It wasn't any group that was saying it. It was the Afghan government that was saying it. Yeah, they deployed a commission to investigate this bombing and came back with the conclusion that it did in fact happen, that it did kill a lot of civilians, in contrast to what the U.S. claimed, that no civilians were killed. And unfortunately, the U.S. is going to keep doing this as long as U.S. media keeps whitewashing these stories.
And very quickly, treaty with the U.S. and Czechoslovakia.
Yeah, the U.S. signed a treaty with Czech Republic, signed a missile shield treaty this week to put in place a radar system to presumably protect the U.S. from attack from missiles from Iran, which is kind of laughable. This is something that has been seen as very provocative with Russia. The U.S. is also negotiating similar treaties with Poland and Lithuania right now. In retaliation today, Russia has cut down the oil supply to the Czech Republic. So we're going to be hearing a lot more about this in weeks ahead.
All right. And events.
A couple of events to talk about this week. First of all, today there's a fundraiser that Code Pink and other groups are doing for Iraqi refugees. It'll be at the Cascade People Center from 5 to 9 o'clock this evening. That's at 309 Pontius Avenue North near the REI down in what used to be called the Cascadia neighborhood back when people were allowed to live there. Thursday evening, Barbara Ehrenreich will be in town. She'll be not at Town Hall. She'll be at the Seattle Public Library Auditorium, what is euphemistically known as the Microsoft Library for some reason, or auditorium rather. But it is a free event, first come, first serve. Barbara Ehrenreich at the Seattle Public Library Thursday evening at 7 o'clock.
All right. talking as we do every week with Jav Parrish and Maria Tomchik, both with Eat the State. And where can people find Eat the State?
Eat the State is in the midst of a fund drive, so we appreciate any help that you can give. It comes out every couple of weeks at bookstores, cafes, public library system, etc., or over the web at www.eatthestate.org with that big spiffy PayPal donation button on the side. And hint, hint. And if you have questions, comments, tips, any kind of feedback you'd like to offer, you can give our voicemail a call at, what's that number, Maria? No, never mind.
719.
Here we go, 206-719-6947, or email us at info@eatthestate.org.